I'd like to begin with a reading from Job. Elihu, who's an interesting character, says in the 33rd chapter, the 14th verse, "For God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when the deep sleep falls upon men while they slumber on their beds." I'm sure that refers to women too. It is interesting that in our Old Testament scriptures, people had no problem valuing dreams. They had no problem valuing them as revelation from God, as insight, as messages. And it's only been in our more recent history that such a phenomenon were looked upon askance and with question. And why that's so is a two-hour lecture, which I'll be glad to give on some other occasion. But basically, we have developed in the Western world a rational, materialistic worldview that has not been able to value the non-rational and the spiritual. And so it's left us with in that kind of poverty. Now, what you're going to get this evening is a four-hour course that I used to teach at the Graduate School of Psychology at Fuller Theological Seminary in 1 hour. So hang on to your hats. I'm going to do more talking than I like to do, but this is a kind of introduction. And feel free to stop me at any time and ask any question that you'd like. And we'll do it that way. Then later on in the week, we're going to have a session where we'd like to invite those of you who care to bring a dream or bring additional questions that this session might provoke in you. And we'll have opportunity to discuss those. The first thing I'd like to do with you this evening is to talk a little bit about the difference between sign and symbol. We use the word symbol a lot in our vocabulary, and therefore I'd like to define it my way for you, so when I use the word, you know at least what I'm talking about, okay? And the way I'm defining it largely comes out of my work as a therapist of the Jungian tradition. Carl Jung's psychology is incidentally called analytic psychology in deference to psychoanalytic theory. And in my own analytic tradition, the word symbol means something that is pregnant with meaning for the person. Something that is pregnant with meaning. It touches the unknown in us. And it can be a word, it can be an image, it can be a thing, it can be a dream, it can be a vision. It can be an experience, but it is something that cannot be totally defined. If a symbol is defined, then it becomes a matter of historical interest, but it loses its symbolic significance because it no longer is pregnant with meaning for us. I think one of the unfortunate things is that so often in the church we have taken symbols and made signs out of them. Often if you go into a church and if you ask for a guided tour, someone gives you a guided tour and they'll point to perhaps a picture or an image in the church and they'll say, "Now, let me tell you what this means. What this means is and they will explain it to you. What they have done is they have probably made a symbol into a sign. A sign is like a stop sign. You see it, and you know what it means. It means stop. Now, that stop sign could have symbolic significance for you. Perhaps you were in a terrible automobile accident, and somehow a stop sign was involved in that. Every time you see a stop sign, it brings up a lot of unresolved things for you. So it could be that a sign could have a symbolic experience. In seminary, we used to take a course called symbolics, and I think it was a wonderful word. The only problem was we took all the symbols and made signs out of them because we explained them all away, and we didn't allow them to have symbolic significance. Now, there are symbols that have remained very much symbols for us in the church. The Eucharist, I think, is very much a symbol, because as much as preachers try to explain to us what that means, nobody ultimately really understands. And there is a sense of mystery, a sense of awe, a sense of God's presence that transcends any understanding. And so it's a powerful symbol for us. More Lutherans show up, at least at my church, whenever we offer the Eucharist than when we don't. And since we're afraid of getting too much of the Lord, we only offer it once a month. Actually, we now offer it every Sunday at the early service, so we're making strides gradually. And I came out of a tradition where we only offered it once a quarter, and then we went and signed up. Did any of you come from that?
Not the American, must have grown up the Methodist.
No, it was Norwegian Lutheran.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But, so some of that, you know, was there anyway. So anyway, the Eucharist would be an example, I think, of something that truly is symbolic for us. Probably many church buildings have a symbolic significance. We go in them and there's a sense of the presence of God, but we can't really explain why. I mean, we can say some things about it. It's the height, you know, or something. And other buildings don't.
I mentioned the word church building. Yeah. That's very different. My dad, for example, gives me a hard time. That church building, or that building over there, where you would go to church, that looks more like an office building.
Right.
Well, I mean, there's no
okay.
So many churches are built with a high pitched roof and a steeple, and so when you see one that doesn't have either one, then you're a little confused, especially.
And
that is a sin, right?
Many church buildings that we've spent millions on just don't cut it symbolically. And I don't know that I can tell you why or why not, but I know if I ask people, does this carry a sense of the presence, a mystery for you, they'll say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't seem to matter how posh it is or how much money we spend on it. And there's something about it that either is symbolic for us or isn't. Now, so dreams are symbols, not signs. Which means no one can write a manual for what they mean. We can do a lot of associating, we can do a lot of suggesting, we can do a lot of guessing, we can do a lot of assisting, we can do a lot of associating. But if we make them into signs, then they are no longer pregnant with possibilities for us. I would say that for example, art and music for me. I wanted to say good art, but then that's according to me. has a symbolic significance for me. It touches me in places that I don't fully understand, and so I love. to live with the symbol and let it continue to nourish me and say things to me that I haven't seen. I remember one time Robert Frost lecturing at UC Berkeley, and he was reading his poetry, and a student offered an interpretation of one of the poems and asked if that was an appropriate interpretation or if that's what the author meant. And he said, "Well, you know, I never thought of that before, but it sounds good to me." The point being that that piece had touched that person at a level that even, you know, Robert Frost hadn't anticipated. So it was truly, it had a symbolic quality to it. Certainly music, again, good music. Does that. Some not so good music is symbolic for me too. I have to deal with that because I don't like it. Okay. Now, I'd like to move quickly to a kind of a brief description of the personality or the psyche as Carl Jung envisioned it, to also help us in our discussion or understanding of where do dreams come from. If one could envision a person as a circle, and if one were to divide the circle at some place, one could describe the lower section, perhaps, as the unconscious, and the upper section as the conscious part of the personality. Actually, in reality, we'd have to put the line up here, like this. Let's say that's the conscious part of the personality. But I don't have enough room to doodle if I do that. So. Jung used the word unconscious quite intentionally. It was Freud who used the word subconscious. And Freud's idea of the subconscious is quite different than Jung's idea of the unconscious. When I'm in a cynical mood, I define Freud's idea of the subconscious as a glory hole of repressed desires. On the other hand, the unconscious of Jung, is a marvelous place. It's Tolkien's trilogy. You know, it's got valleys and mountains and all kinds of interesting figures that run around with hairy toes, and they have great soap operas, and they get into trouble, and they meet wild creatures and beasts, and they climb mountains, and they have hair-raising experiences that makes your hair stand on end. It's like your dreams, right? You know? You say, "My goodness, where did all these wonderful things come from?" another difference is that Freud had a reductionist idea of what was going on in the psyche, and that basically the ideal was to get free from any dependencies, that particularly any of those that had been repressed and projected outside oneself, that were in the subconscious. And so he saw religion, for example, largely as an expression of our paternal or maternal dependency needs. And if we would free ourselves, that was projected outwardly into a sky god and all of the attending theology and so forth. On the other hand, Jung saw the movement of the psyche as forward going. And he saw religion as the fullest expression symbolically of what people could become, and containing the transcendent dimensions of the personality. And that's another thing, is that in Jung's unconscious, it's not, I've drawn a circle here, But the psyche is not confined to our time and our our space, but has connections with things that are much larger than us. And so it's not confined just to our own body and our own time and our own space. Now, what's in the unconscious for Jung? What's in the unconscious are the stuff of the unconscious. Well, I guess nothing's in the unconscious here tonight. Anyway, my pen has run out. If I could, I'd draw a lot of circles there for you of different sizes and shapes. And we would call those circles complexes. And that's a word that also has crept a lot into our vocabulary these days. We talk about so-and-so having a... Oh, is that where they're going? Oh, good. Okay. The stuff of the unconscious is complexes, and we have big ones and little ones, and they overlap with each other, and they move around. They're always moving, and at the center of these complexes, of each complex, is an entity that Jung called an archetype, and these are themes or motifs that we all share. In fact, all of humanity shares these archetypes. And certain archetypes get developed more in some cultures than other cultures. But as the individual, however we get these things, then the personal experiences of the individual collect around these archetypes. And the more experience that one has or collects around a particular archetype, the bigger that complex gets. In fact, sometimes the complexes get so big that instead of having a complex, the complex has us. And we find ourselves doing things, and we say, my goodness, why did I do that? You know, like St. Paul. Or we slip and we say the darndest things. A while back at a funeral, I found myself congratulating someone rather than giving them my condolences. Why did I say that? I say the darndest things sometimes, especially in public. I don't know. Or you find yourself reacting to a certain situation, either positively or negatively, a really strong reaction. You know, I mean, you haven't sat down and thought and said, "Now I'm going to react this way." Suddenly, you react, and you have a lot of passion, a lot of intensity about a particular situation. And when that happens, you just about can be sure that it's a complex that's kicking up its heels. And in that sense, the complex has got you. Of course, lots of things like phobias are obviously complexes. Those of us who have a hard time not eating too much probably develop an eating complex. And other smoking, you know, drinking, lots of things can become complexes with us, so that we are complexed, we are compulsed in our behavior. Now, what's going on in our dreams is, in a sense, the story of our complexes in visual form for us. Particularly the images that we need to pay attention to, and we'll talk about this in a minute. Let me talk just quickly about a couple other complexes. One is the ego, which functions for Jung in the center of consciousness, not at the center of the personality. So it's different than contemporary ego psychologies. At the very center of the personality, the thing that's kind of managing this whole mess for us unconsciously is a notion that Jung called the self, with a capital S. And Jung said that that is the image of God within us. When I first read that, I said, oh, I need to know more about all of this. And it is the self that chooses the stories that we are presented every evening to deal with the next day. So that's a 4-hour course in analytic psychology. There's a lot more to it that we could talk about. Well, let me just say one more thing, because I'm going to talk a little bit about this indirectly in Vespers this evening. Another way we find out about some of these complexes is that we project them outside ourselves. For example, one of our major complexes is called the shadow, and which contains all the stuff that we wouldn't be caught dead being or doing or associating with. So have you ever wondered why you just met somebody and you dislike them? I mean, you just don't, you know, and you say, now why is that? You know, I mean, they haven't done anything to me, they haven't hit me, they haven't threatened me, I just don't like them. Well, folks, guess who you just met? You. A dimension of yourself. The same thing when you love somebody. Falling in love, is a great expression, because that's exactly what we do. Fall in. Where have we fallen in? And we're projecting a lot of stuff on another person. Now, thank God we do that, or we'd never get together and never get married, and you know, so there's some real positive things about that. Now, as I am convinced, after years of being a therapist now, more convinced than ever, that God works through our unconscious to assist us in understanding what the next steps are in our life. God works with us in many ways, through our relations, through our intelligence, through our experiences, and so forth. But God also works with us in some very profound ways through the unconscious. I think this has also been the resource for some of the great spiritual insight, some of the great literature, some of the great art, some of the great music. Where does it come from? It comes from our depths. And so, now the next thing I'd like to do is to share with you a few words formally. And lost a couple of the pages to that. That's an interesting problem, isn't it? See, I guess I'm not supposed to share all that with you or something.
You have a Freudian slip like that, what do you call it,
Why won't the computer recall these things?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a... You mean my paper, or...? Okay. Okay, well, let me just share with you what I have, and we'll see how well I do at covering up the transitions. My parishioners are pretty good about telling when the text runs out and I'm winging it. Actually, this is a little thing that I wrote for Abington is publishing a new dictionary of pastoral care. And I was privileged to write the section along with Jack Sanford on Jung's contribution to pastoral care from a more practical perspective. So it was supposed to be out a year ago. I'd make it out 2 years from now. The editor is a friend of mine. He's routinely a year late on everything. So. Okay. Jung believed that all dreams are related in a very central way to our psychological development. They all have to do with individuation. Individuation is the word that Jung used for, we might use other words like self-actualization or coming to oneself, words like that. Individuation means, in analytic psychology, the process of first differentiating the parts of the psyche and then harmoniously blending them. Even dreams that are just a rehearsal of what you have been doing during the day are important. They are important because they probably indicate a lack of attention to what you have been doing during the day. Often you'll have a dream like that, kind of rehearsing the events of the day. On the other extreme, people have very powerful dreams where their response is, wow. They ask, where did that come from? Often these dreams have very strange symbols that seem alive and will make your hair stand on end. The dream will be full of power, and you may feel perhaps like Moses felt when he saw the burning bush. In this moment, something has come upon you that is totally other than yourself. Now, how did Jung feel we should approach dreams as well as daytime visions? He felt that we should be open-minded and not doctrinaire. A Jungian analyst will stay with the dream images and go where the dream images go. The analyst will have no idea what the outcome will be. With the client, the therapist awaits the guidance of the dreams. For example, if you dream of George Washington, the analyst won't tell you that that is your father. And if you dream of a guru, the analyst won't tell you that that is your analyst or your priest or your pastor or your rabbi. The analyst stays with what the dream says. If you dream of a pencil with a broken point, the analyst does not assume that you have a castration complex. Rather, she assumes that the dream has to do with a broken pencil. Jung broke free of the heavy-handed, dreary cause-effect method of dream interpretation. Unfortunately, a lot of this mythology and methodology, both mythology and methodology, is returning today in popular writing on newsstands where dream interpretation literature abounds. Dream analysis for Jung was not a morbid, laborious self-examination of all of our imperfections. That kind of approach I like to characterize it as like a centipede who, when he considered how he walked, fell over into a ditch and would never walk again. Jung believed that the urge of God in life is forward going. Therefore, he was not interested in dredging up all kinds of things from one's past. He believed like Eliade, who said, life cannot be repaired, it can only be recreated. Life cannot be repaired, it can only be recreated. Now by that what he meant was that obviously when we are wounded, that wound is a part of our past history. And usually things can never be the same again. They can be better, but not the same. And so that God is interested in recreating in a new way life, not just making it like it was. Jung believed that every dream tries to recreate us. That every dream tries to recreate us, to make us whole. Jung observed that dreams compensate for our conscious standpoint. Thus, they are always bringing exactly what we need to move forward. You see, our conscious standpoint is very narrow. What we know consciously is a very narrow and one-sided, often one-sided perspective. What we don't know is often much fuller and richer with potential for us. That's why, like T.S. Eliot says in the Four Quartets, I believe it's in East Coker, the way from where you are to the place where you do not yet know is the way of not knowing. The way of no ecstasy. And so one of the ways we get in touch with that which we do not yet know is through symbols that connect us up with that which we do not yet know. It is God's way, or I should say, one of God's ways of guiding us in our growth. You see, if we only listen to our conscious standpoint, then it is difficult to hear the fullness of what God intends. It's kind of like if you only lived with your own attitudes on an island and your own perspective on an island. You never subjected that to others in the Christian community, for example, or to others in the world. You'd end up with a very narrow kind of perspective on life and the issues. Our conscious standpoint is shaped by our ego and what it selects. The ego in Jung's psychology is the complex that selects what we're going to remember, what we're not going to remember, what we're going to be conscious of, what we're not going to be conscious of, and so forth. Our unconscious standpoint compensates for what our consciousness leaves out. Al Kreinheder, a Jungian analyst in Los Angeles, once said in a lecture, if you would suspend your disbelief, he often says that creative people believe just about everything. Now, you have to understand that not so much in terms of intellectual concepts, but in terms of believing that just about anything is possible. Okay? So when people tell them about an experience that they had, they're open to that possibility and saying, oh, that you really didn't have that, that isn't true. For example, as Lutheran Christians, it's very hard for us to believe how the Spirit of God works in some people. Being very much raised in a rational tradition, I had a hard time believing that people got healed in some strange ways that I don't even understand until I witnessed that. And I don't still understand it, but, they got better. On the other hand, some other people I know got healed, I was listening to Norman Cousins the other day. Have you all read his book on the anatomy of an illness? He got cancer, he decided to get well. His remedy was vitamin C and Laurel and Hardy films. Humor and vitamins, and he got well. I don't understand that either. So anyway, if you would suspend your disbelief and would openly minded with the spirit of a child, and have you heard that someplace before? From Jesus? And following the leadership of a dream, you may have to do some strange things. You might have to turn some of your moral convictions inside out. Sometimes you may even seem like a fool. But the eventual reward of following your dream, letting them guide you, is that you will become what you have always meant to be. And that is the best thing that can happen to you. It's something that we have to trust. Okay, let me quickly go through some typical types of issues that come up in dreams. and also a little bit about how to work with them. And I'm going to kind of co-mingle this. Jung had a very simple, one other reason why I like Jung is that he had a very simple way of describing human development, as opposed to someone like Piaget and so forth, who had many stages. Jung divided life into the first half and the second half. And I can remember that much. That's fairly easy for me. And in fact, he said, in his time, in his day and age, which was when he was doing this work, which was 50, 60 years ago, he at that time, he wouldn't see anyone in analysis until they were 35. He said, before that, it's a waste of time. They're not really ready to look at themselves. I don't think that's true anymore, because I think younger people are asking second half of life questions. And also, a lot of people in the second half of life are not asking second half of life questions. Working on the first half. So it's all... probably the reality is we do a little of both all the time. I don't know. But anyway, you know, all these psychologists have to have a system. Although Jung was the most unsystematic of any of them. And he's kind of like Luther, you know, with 59 volumes and contradicts himself. And it depends on whether you read early Jung or middle Jung or late Jung or, you know. And so you have to sort it out for yourself. Anyway, in terms of the first half of life, one of the issues is ego building. It's necessary to have a healthy and strong ego. Today there's a lot of talk about that, and you hear a lot about that. It's usually talked about in terms of building self-esteem, a positive self-image, and so forth. And often young people will have, I've noticed this in my children's dreams, my own children's dreams, as they've told them to me, all the exploits of the hero. And doing heroic things, for example, would be an example of how a young person is trying to develop a positive self-image and a strong ego. If a person doesn't have a strong ego, you see, then it's so easy for the unconscious to just take over the personality, and the personality becomes the unconscious. And of course, we call that insanity in our society. Now, some of the other issues is that we all have to work at getting free from paternal and maternal influences, particularly the negative side of the mother, which always threatens to consume. And or the lack, the negative side of the father, which is kind of the opposite usually, is just not there. It's when the father is not there. And so one gets very wounded by that. And there's lots of interesting mythology about, in Greek mythology, for example, about the feminine, the negative aspect of the feminine, consuming the child and so forth. One also has to, or in the Electra myth, in the rake of Persephone, where you have the abuse of the father too, that's another illustration. Or the lack of a father to instruct the child how to function in the world, the positive father. So there are maternal and paternal negative influences that have to be gotten free from. Also, the integration of the shadow. One has to come face to face with one's own darkness in order to have enough courage and fire to do what one needs to do in the second half of life. So that means one has to be able to accept one's own limitations. And often many of those things that that one has been taught that one ought not to be and do. For men, for example, they need to separate themselves from the mother and develop a positive relationship with the feminine. Unfortunately, most men do that outwardly, but don't do that work inwardly in our society. And for women, they need to separate themselves from the mother and develop a positive relationship with the masculine within themselves. Now, in the second half of life, some of the themes that have come up in the clients that I work with are often, you often see themes like in dreams, like blind alleys. Perhaps a person is coming to an end of something, and they need to make a transition into something else, a new chapter in their life. Or they're beginning for the first time to really come to terms with themselves and face themselves. Often in dreams, you'll have experiences like election experiences, being king or queen for the day, for example. Or as you begin to journey seriously, you may meet an inner guide, a person, a figure that's helpful to you. Or crossing a threshold is often a common theme. Or often a very common one is disillusion or dismemberment, where you get sliced up or you're observing something being sliced up or killed. And something is changing for you. Something old is dying, something new is being born. Or some kind of renewal or reward experience. Okay, now, what do you do with these dreams? It's very important to write your dreams down, if you can, and catch as many details as you can. When you start doing this, you may not remember very much at all. And you may just remember a feeling or just a couple of things about it. And then write down your associations with it, everything that comes to mind in terms of how you felt about it. How did the dream make you feel? What impact did it have on you? Any associations that you have? And then you can begin even to do a little research if you want. What analogies do you find in literature and art, religious experience, myth, and so on that seem to fit with your dream? It's very helpful to have a companion in this process, particularly one who has worked at their own, or even better, someone who's had some training in this to help you work with your dreams. Jung never used the word interpret dreams. And because even though having an intellectual understanding of what's going on can be helpful, a dream is really its own best statement of itself. Its own best statement of itself. No one can improve upon that statement, really. And it's not a coded message. A dream is meant to be more than it's meant to mean. And its intent is to heal, to recreate, to move a person along. People that have very limited intellectual facilities benefit as much from dreams and their healing power and their healing influence and their recreating influence as do people of tremendous intellectual ability. And the dream itself, it is the dream itself that exerts the magic on the personality and its transformation, not the interpretation. Now, Native Americans and other peoples understood that. And so, as they got into their symbols, it worked its wonder upon them. And they didn't have to understand it intellectually. Jack Sanford talks about walking around the dream or dreaming the dream forward, living with the dream. Often I'll have people do dialogues with characters in the dreams to see what the characters actually say to them. Often the dreams, of course, come out of a particular context. And that's why dreams can't, they usually cannot ever be worked with outside of the context that the individual lives in, because they're very much related to our situation in life. And as a therapist, you often work with a series of dreams of a person. And of course, you know intimately what's going on in their life, and so the dream, it's very difficult to work with a dream kind of in a vacuum without knowing what's going on in the life of the person. And so they come out of a specific context. Okay, let's, in the few minutes we have left, and then we'll open it up for questions here. Let me talk about a couple of states and give you some examples of some dreams that often come from such states. For example, anxiety. I tried to think of dreams that come out of my own experience, particularly. Sometimes I've dreamt of being unprepared for an examination. Or more particularly with me, I can't find my place in the liturgy on Sunday morning, and there I am. Or I get in the pulpit and all my papers have disappeared. People have told me about being pursued by some threatening person or creature, and it's often been a dream related to some anxiety that they have about something. That could also be a shadow dream, where there's something about ourselves that we don't want to face, and a person can have a dream like that. Or dreams suggesting physical danger to the dream ego, like falling off. Any of you ever fall off of things? You just keep, but you usually wake up before you hit bottom, right? I told the last group last week, I said, if you hit bottom, come and see me. One gal did. Glad to reassure her that she wasn't going to die. And so that some other things were going on there. Or threatened by natural events, the tornado, a hurricane, you know, a tidal wave, standing on the beach, a huge tidal wave. And that could also mean being threatened by being taken over by the unconscious, but so you have to know the context. But though depression, as we all know, depression can be related from psychogenic to organic causes. And so whenever you're depressed, you really should check out your body to make sure you don't have a chemical imbalance of some kind. But having done that, and you're still depressed, then you can usually be fairly well assured something else is going on. And it could be any number of things. But the most common thing is that you're angry, and you've turned that anger inward. And that has made you immobilized, and you're kind of mucking around, and no energy, and so forth. And so it's, and often in a dream, when that's the case, there'll be a lot of anger going on, often towards the dream ego. And I should say the dream ego and your awake ego are not the same thing. The dream ego is the dream ego. Your ego is something else. So don't get them confused. So if something happens to your dream ego, that's not going to happen to you. Most dreams talk about what's going on inside you and have little to do with predicting what may go on outside you. But anything is possible, so I wouldn't want to state it as an absolute, because that also does happen too. Sometimes people have a lot of transference or counter-transference dreams. Somebody that you're very fond of or is very special to you, And often ways you haven't been too aware of will show up in your dreams. Maybe you're having a love affair with them, or chasing them, trying to seduce them, or they you, if there's some counter transference going on, and so forth. Well, a couple of common dream motifs, just for the fun of it. Snakes, any of you ever dream of snakes? I always get asked about snakes, so I thought I'd think of them. If you're a good Freudian, you'd say obviously it has some sexual connotation. It can have a phallic significance, meaning. But it can also have a lot to do with instinctual energy that's wanting out, or wisdom, or healing, or a new awareness of consciousness. Any of you have automobile dreams? You're driving an automobile?
Yeah.
That seems very popular, often out of control. You have to examine those dreams in light of what's going on. Are you driving the car? Are you riding in the car? Are you just observing the car? Where are you? Is the car just out of control? Is it about to go into a deep abyss? What's going on? Often, when we're feeling out of control in life, we may have a wonderful automobile dream. Or if you do crash into the water in the dream, it may mean that it could mean you're anxious about something. It could mean that you're headed in some direction that you need to re-examine, and your unconscious knows that. So you need to take a look at that and see if, in fact, maybe you should make some other choices. Houses. Anyone dream of houses? Lots of houses. I think the house is probably the most common dream for the psyche itself. I have wonderful house dreams where I'm exploring sometimes the basement and sometimes the attic, and rearranging the furniture. Any of you do that sort of thing in your dreams? Sometimes there's been a room that I can't get in, and I wonder what's in there. So a house dream can be important. Well, you've got a whole semester course. We've got 5 minutes to ask a few questions. I hope I've just given you a glimpse, just a taste, a smell, a sniff. And if you decide it's worthwhile, you can come back later in the week and we get more specifically into some dreams. Yeah.
What prevents people from remembering dreams?
Okay.
How often does a person dream and why can't remember?
Yeah. Well, most research says that everybody dreams every night. In fact, there's a lot of good research that says if you don't dream, it's hazardous to your health. I mean, physically, you need to dream in order to maintain your health. I honestly have worked with some people that I'm not sure dreamt every night. Sometimes it was because there was so much, they were kind of cooking in their life at that particular moment in time, and they had a lot of creative things that were being expressed outwardly in a variety of ways, and so the unconscious didn't really have much to do, I think, and didn't need it to do very much. But that's an unusual situation. I think most of us dream every night. Now, why don't we remember the dreams? First of all, I think we have to make a conscious choice to remember them. And we kind of have to work at that. In other words, you have to say to yourself, I'm going to remember my dreams. And you have to let the unconscious know that you mean business. And one way you can do that is by getting a notebook, putting it by the side of your bed with a pencil, and telling yourself you're going to wake up in the morning, you're going to write that dream down. And the first morning you may only get just a little glimpse. I mean, you can't remember hardly anything, but it's just a word or something, feeling. You write it down. Then the unconscious knows that you're serious. And the unconscious is very sensitive of what's going on around it and whether you mean business with it or not. If you don't mean business, then it gets away with murder. I mean, it's very, you know, it's not for consciousness in and of itself. The self is, and so it pushes up these images for us. But now if you still can't remember them, then there's probably some resistance going on that needs to be looked at, and that can be any number of things. And I must say, I've gone through periods of not being able to remember my dreams, and I had to deal with my resistance to that.
Yeah. There are some that you remember fairly as well, and others you have to remember it all.
Yeah. There's also, you know, big dreams and little dreams. Little dreams could come from, you know, having too much Mexican food. I don't know. Garlic will do it to me every time. But there are little dreams, you know, kind of rehearsing what's going on during the day, or something that you need to remember that you've forgotten, or something like that that comes up. But I'll tell you, if you have a big dream, you'll remember. In fact, it may even wake you up, and your hair will stand on end, and you won't forget it. You may not even have to write that one down ever. So, and they usually, you know, they're full of power, and they usually have a very often transcendent dimension to them.
Are things that don't seem symbolic really symbolic? Like, just a few days ago, I woke up, my supervisor was screaming at me. That's not common, but...
Does she actually do that? Or?
She's a little sneaky.
She's normally sneaky, and in the dream she was screaming at you. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, was it really her, and is that what was really happening, and was it really something else?
Well, as I said, most dreams have to do with dimensions of yourself. However, it could be that she's been sneaky and you hadn't been paying attention, and your unconscious wanted you to. Maybe you're getting used by her, and your unconscious knew that, and your consciousness wasn't aware of that. But you need to be aware of that. I don't know. You know. I mean, that's just a possibility. Would that make any sense?
Yeah.
So she was screaming at you. You know, the unconscious was trying to get our attention about something that was important that we were neglecting to acknowledge. And then, okay, one more. I got to do Vespers tonight. Two more. Okay.
Often when I've had a really bad dream, something bad happened to me, while I'm still asleep, myself says to myself, don't worry, this is just a dream. How do you account for that? And that has happened to me more times. But I don't know that until I'm lying awake, and I think that I'm still dreaming at the time that I'm aware that it's a dream.
Well, I would just take it at face value. Could be some anxiety. There's, you know, we all have dialogues that go on within us. We're all a series of lots of opposites and pulls, and often we have these conversations that are going on. So maybe you've got some anxiety that's unresolved, and at the same time, and you're struggling with resolving that and not trying to feel so anxious about it. And are trying to figure out how to feel about your anxiety, where it is. And one side of you says, don't worry about it. The unconscious says, you got some issues you need to deal with. So I don't know, could be something like that. We have to talk some more. One more, and then we really do need
The dream of being pursued, you don't really know what's pursuing you, but you're being pursued and you're having difficulty moving.
Right.
Feet are just...
Yeah.
Is that just tension and anxiety that's causing that?
Yeah, it really can be, or it could be something. It could be something that you need to face that doesn't seem very friendly, and your unconscious wants it to catch up with you, but yet you don't want it to catch up with you. And if you turn and befriend it, like Jesus says we should do, and love it, you may discover some wonderful things. Or it can be just anxiety. Jack Sanford, in his book on dreams, has a marvelous scenario in there about an experience like that, where the person was actually dying physically. Nobody could figure out why he had a dream like that. This is to make a very long story short. He finally turned and faced and embraced it, discovered that there was an event in his past where he had been involved in some shady dealings that he had totally repressed. And when he was able to accept that about himself, you know, that he'd actually been a part of those things, he did that, that's part of who he was. Befriend that figure. First of all, the figure went away in the dream. And then secondly, he got better physically.
What is the name of that book?
Dreams, God's Forgotten Language by Jack Sanford, S-A-N-F-O-R-D. Thank you very much.
Thank you.